One of my favorite books by far is called The Power of the Powerless, Testimony of a Brother's Love. And it's written by a guy named Christopher DeVink. And Chris DeVink had a brother who was severely handicapped, mentally and physically, was told, his parents were told, you don't have to take him home from the hospital. There are places for people like him. They took him home. They were told he would never live to his first birthday. They were told he'd never live to his third birthday. They were told he would never live to his sixth birthday. He died at the age of 33. And as Christopher wrote about that experience of taking care of Oliver, he wrote an article about it that was published in the Wall Street Journal, and letters began to flood into him of people throughout the world who had learned just incredible lessons through suffering, specifically about children suffering. One such letter was about a girl named Lauren, and her father wrote the letter. He said that when we went to give birth to Lauren, I decided to stay out in the waiting room. We were going to have a C-section, and I get squeamish, and my wife really didn't want to see me faint. And so I stayed in the waiting room, and the first sign that there was something wrong was when doctors and nurses began running in and out. I was later told that Lauren had ingested meconium, had breathed meconium into her lungs before she was born, filling her lungs up with corruption. And they had to rush her to the NICU, the neonatal intensive care unit. And he described standing there, looking through the window at his sick daughter, and she was fully, came full term. She was 8.5 pounds. Everything about her looked healthy. She was in this unit next to children who had cleft palates and who were born just wickedly prematurely, and some of them weren't a third of her size. And everything about her looked like she was the healthiest one in there. And he actually mentioned that to one of the doctors. And the doctor said, sir, I don't want you to have any false expectations. Your daughter is by far the sickest child in this hospital. And a few days later, she died. I tell you that story to open up this series because for this reason. What we're going to talk about for the next 4 weeks in this summer series that we do where y'all get to pick the topics and I preach, and then we have question and answer. And throughout the sermon, there will be a phone number on the screen. If you want to text messages, questions in at any time, that would be great. So we'll have some that we're ready to answer as soon as the service is over. But what you have to know to understand how to converse, how to confront people, how to understand our culture and live and thrive in it. The first thing you have to know is this. Despite the fact that sometimes it looks extremely healthy, sometimes in middle-class America, this world looks wonderful, is wonderful. Despite that appearance, it is under the power of death. It is polluted by death. Everything that you see, touch, hear, and feel is dying. And it has been ever since sin let death into the world. And you have to understand that as the context. If you understand that as the context of the world, then you can begin to see what God is doing to redeem it. But if you close your eyes to that deadness, if you choose to just ignore that, then you're going to live a life of superficiality and ultimately of faithlessness, bitterness, and cynicism. The question that we come to the Bible with is, how do we learn to dwell in the midst of a dying world without losing hope or faith? If we want to have a meaningful, hopeful life, if you want to have meaningful, deep relationships that if you want to be part of the solution and not part of the problem, then we have to acknowledge the reality that this world is far sicker than it looks. It's dying. And to understand that, we're going to open the Bible to Habakkuk chapter 3. We've already opened the Bible to Lamentations chapter 3, and both of these chapters are extremely similar. In Lamentations, we have Jeremiah, the weeping prophet, who is brokenhearted over Jerusalem. He's brokenhearted over Judah, over the sin there, over the superficiality there, over the failure to repentance, over the failure to confess their sin and to turn their lives around, and ultimately over their exile. Habakkuk, in the chapter that we're about to read, it's only a three-chapter book, kind of in the end of the Old Testament. It's a little bit hard to find. It's very hard to pronounce. Pronounce it like tobacco. But what happens in this book is Habakkuk is a prophet, and he is distraught over Israel, or over Judah. Israel's already been taken captive. And he is disappointed and brokenhearted. And he is crying out to the Lord, "Why are you letting such injustice take place?" And God answers him. And the answer was worse than the problem. God says, "I see all the injustice, Habakkuk, and I'm going to answer that. I'm going to deal with it. I'm going to bring the Chaldeans in, and they're going to take everybody captive. I'm punishing the wicked by the sword of the Chaldean." And Habakkuk begins to tremble. That's worse. You're going to turn us over to them? And then at the end of his book, we read this. Please stand as we read. It's in your bulletin from Habakkuk chapter 3. And what I really want you to see is how he responds, how he receives the news and yet maintains hope. He says, "I hear and my body trembles. My lips quiver at the sound. Rottenness enters into my bones. My legs tremble beneath me. Yet I will quietly wait for the day of trouble to come upon those who invade us. Though the fig tree should not blossom, nor fruit be on the vines, the produce of the olive fail and the fields yield no food, though the flock be cut off from the folds and there be no herd in the stalls, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will take joy in the God of my salvation. God the Lord is my strength. He makes my feet like the deer's. He makes me tread on my high places. To the choir master with stringed instruments." Thus far, the reading of God's Word. Please be seated. I love the way that passage ends with that little phrase, "to the choir master with stringed instruments," because it tells us Habakkuk wants us to sing this. It's a song. He wants it to become part of worship. These two things, side by side, I hear and I tremble. My bones are hurting within me. The misery of the world, it's so broken that I feel it to my bones, and yet I will trust in you. How do we have both? How do we have both? The first thing is we have to understand, we have to truly understand that our world is fallen and it is deeply broken. Now, in the 10th century, the church universal, the church worldwide, split into the eastern and western halves. And the western half, which is us, we're part of the western hemisphere, focused on the sin, the sinfulness of the world. And we focused on original sin and what Jesus has done to atone for sins. And I believe all that and all that stuff is very important, but it's not what we're going to talk about today. The eastern half focused upon the death, the misery of the world, that sin brought death into the world. Adam brought in death and it has reigned and it is has dominion over us so that every part of this world is stained by death. Paul says in Romans chapter 5 that sin came into the world through one man and death through sin. So death spread to all men because all sinned. The way my New Testament professor described it, he said that sin snuck in through the window. Sin talked its way into the world through Adam. And then sin went and opened the door and let the thug of death come in. And that thug has bound us all and has enslaved us all until Jesus comes to free us. What does that mean? It means that, reality check. What it means is that every person you see is literally dying. It means that every relationship you're a part of, this is happy news, every relationship you're a part of, if you love anybody, that love is going to lead you to being brokenhearted either because they betray you and leave you or because they die. And the only way to avoid one of those two ends is if you die first. That's the reality of the world. And if you don't embrace that reality of the world, then you're going to go through this world superficially, and you'll end up being cynical and you'll and be in great danger of losing your faith. It means that every relationship is dying, every institution, every organization, every profession, every community, every city, every nation, every culture is dying. And this pollution of death is over everything, over every household, over every person. And it pollutes everything we touch. You can think of, if you think of culture, worldwide culture, as a glass of water. What we're saying is that sin introduced a few drops of cyanide into the glass. We're not saying that everything in the glass is pure cyanide. We're not saying there's nothing in it but pure death. But we're saying every atom of that water has been contaminated. There is no safe place to drink from it. It's everywhere, and it's unavoidable. What does that mean? It means that we stain everything we touch. The Greek Orthodox will teach us that the fear of death causes us to feel insecure. And that feeling of insecurity will cause us to distrust others and to protect ourselves at all costs. It means that at the very best, we ruin things. In the very best of situations, we ruin things. Bianca and I spent a week in Sonoma, California, which in my mind is about as close to paradise as you can get. Primarily because of the weather. I'll just be honest. The weather is always perfect. And if that may sound superficial, but just think, how easy has it been to be in a bad mood this week? Right? I mean, when it's 105 degrees, if someone doesn't come to a full stop before they turn right on red, you want to kill them. You know, and so just put that in reverse. If it were always, if every day were 72 degrees with no humidity, if every day were room temperature, and everybody you saw were was just like you, was very homogenous, having exorbitantly high property values does that, and everybody's nice, being wine country where everybody's had two glasses of wine today does that, it is just almost perfect. It feels perfect. And yet, they are dividing at the seams. They're at the brink of civil war in Sonoma, California, over leaf blowers. Somebody decided that their city, though almost perfect, wasn't perfect enough because leaf blowers were too noisy. And so they brought it to the city council, and the city council banned leaf blowers by a vote of 3-2. And then one of the voters changed his mind and reinstituted leaf blowers, and everybody in the city is at war with everybody else over whether or not we can have leaf blowers. At the very best, we're going to pollute it. At the very best, we're going to argue about what can we do to make it just a little better. And at worst, we have slums filled with violence and sex trafficking and manipulation and murder. And everywhere in between, death reigns in this culture. Death has always reigned in this culture. This culture is not going to hell. It has always been dead. Ever since Genesis chapter 6, when the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intention of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And the Lord regretted that he had made man on the earth, and it grieved him to his heart. I want you to let those words weigh in on you. The Lord regretted that he made men on the earth, and it grieved him to his heart. He's sad. The destruction, the violence of human against human makes him sad. That's the world that we live in. And ignoring that truth leads to shipwreck. The first thing I want you to see is that both Habakkuk and Jeremiah sat down in the reality. They did not ignore it. They did not deny the complete awfulness of the world. They did not deny the truth. We want to ignore it. We want to turn off the TV. We want to do like Martha Stewart. I don't know if y'all remember, Martha Stewart used to have, sell recipes and have her own little cooking shows. And then she was indicted for insider trading. I don't know. I have no opinion about that. But and all these reporters were surrounding her one day, and they were asking her all these questions about, is she going to go to jail or trial? And she's trying to sell her new cookbook. And finally she gets frustrated, and she goes, I just want to focus on my salad. Don't you ever feel that way? I just want to focus on my salad. I don't want to know about the news. I don't want to have an opinion about every wrong thing that's going on in this country. I don't want to take sides on every issue. I just want to focus on my little salad and have a nice salad. But Habakkuk and Jeremiah didn't do that. They sat down in the misery and they grieved it to their bones. And I want you to know that that is the first thing this text tells us to do. Ignoring reality leads to your destruction. And it leads to your destruction in five ways. The first way is a destruction of superficiality. It's the idea that the world's not broken. There's no trembling, no weeping, never crying, never feeling the brokenness of the world in your bones. Just focusing on your little world of sports and home and entertainment and protecting your family and keeping everything just perfectly safe in here. It's a very childish mentality. It's the attitude of, I'm going to let mommy and daddy face those big bad things out there, and I'm just going to play with my toys. And you never mature, and you never become a person of depth, and you never become a person who can handle conflict, and you bear no resemblance to the man of sorrows who is acquainted with grief. You have no capacity for mourning or for crying. You have no ability to carry hope through the valley of the shadow of death. You're no good to your friends who are suffering and mourning because you can't walk with them where you haven't gone. I wish there were a way to teach you maturity. I wish you could just catch it by reading about it. You can't. The only way you're ever going to truly believe that God will walk with you through the valley of the shadow of death is to walk through the valley of the shadow of death and feel Him there beside you every step of the way. So it is to weep and to weep on His shoulders and let Him wipe your tears. And that makes you a person of depth. Of richness, who can love and be loved. And we live in a church that is absolutely superficial, in a church culture that is absolutely superficial, because we are afraid to be like Jesus, afraid to be the man of sorrows who wept over Jerusalem, who wept over his friends, who was acquainted with grief. The first way that ignoring the truth leads to shipwreck is through superficiality. The world's not broken. The second way is through a loss of faith. The easiest thing to do is just to abandon your faith. And what that says is the world is broken and God's the one who broke it. When you fail to look honestly at the corruption of the world, but you can't miss the sorrow, your temptation, your first temptation is to look for somebody to blame. And the easiest person to blame is God. It's His fault. Why won't He fix it? And the Bible answers that question. It's an answer that we don't like, but it has an answer. And that answer is this. He could have eradicated the dominion of death, but the only way He could have done that was through the nuclear option. You know, when high school kids sit around and talk about how they would fix the Middle East, they all say the same thing. Well, I'd just drop a nuclear bomb on it. Yes, that would get rid of all the terrorists. It would also get rid of all the humans, all the men, women, and children. And you would have become the terrorist. You would be the bad guy. But it would get rid of the problem. Well, God could have gotten rid of all the evil, all the suffering in this world. All He would have to do is kill all of us. Because the place where evil lives is in our own hearts. And He had a problem. His problem is this. He's a little bit silly, honestly. You can almost look at him as being pathetic. He fell in love with his own parasite. He just loved us too much. In a perfect world is a world that you and I would have never been in. And He loved us too much to have that world. The first solution to the brokenness of the world is to ignore it, to say it's not broken. The second one is to say it's God's fault. The third one is a kind of a tribalistic solution. It says, they broke it. It's y'all's fault. It localizes the problems and says that all of the problems in the world are the result of the other tribe. It gives me the benefit of freeing up God, and God is clearly on my side. And it gives me the benefit of clearing up me, right? Me and God, we're together, we're part of the solution. Y'all are all part of the problem. And it's a very tempting view. It means you accept without question the lines and the teachings of your own group. And it means that you hate everything that comes out of the other group, regardless of its merit. And we see this all over the world, and it's not a new thing. This is not something that started with Karl Rove or Bill Clinton. It's something that's been going on since the beginning of the earth. The church blames the unbeliever or the scholar or the scientist. The Democrat blames the Republican. The Republican blames the Democrat. The Muslim blames the Jew. The Jew blames the Muslim. Whites blame the blacks. Blacks blame the whites. On and on it goes. It's your fault. This world is broken and it's your fault. And if everybody were just part of our tribe, which clearly has God on our side, everything would be fixed. And it leads to incredible self-righteousness, arrogance. It's what Jesus combated in the Pharisees. It leads to a church that is just intolerable with its lack of compassion, with its ignorance, and with its refusal to deal with the real depth of their own problems and repentance. And it leads to death. Well, we can say we can refuse to believe the world's broken. We can say God broke it. We can say they broke it. Or we can become an idealist and say, well, the world's not broken that bad. I mean, it's broken, but it can be fixed. If everybody would just behave, if everybody would just do right, we could fix it. We simplify the problems and we look for easy answers. Now, this is really tempting, especially for Christians whose answer to the brokenness of the world, and this is going to kind of sit at home here, so let's just take a deep breath. Take a deep drink of Jesus. I love every one of you. I've done this. We've all committed this sin, okay? For many of us, the way we deal with the problems of the world are we ignore them. We shut them out. They're all out there outside of our little house. And we focus on our family whom we try to perfect. And all we need is someone to tell us what to believe and what to do. And if we can just believe the right thing and do the right thing, then at least the world won't be broken for us. And there is no shortage of people willing to sell you their books and tell you everything to say and think and do so that your world won't be broken anymore. They have names like Bill Gothard and Doug Wilson and Joel Osteen, and it goes on and on and on. If you'll just pray the right thing, if you'll say the right thing, if you'll teach the right way, if you'll date the right way, nothing's going to be broken. And it's basically, instead of seeing the world as a tragedy, this mentality sees the world like a romantic comedy. You know, like there's problems, but you always get together at the end, right? You know, the romantic comedy, they all follow the same formula. You know, they meet, they don't like each other, they like each other, they love each other, and then they separate. There's a big conflict, and they separate. And then one person will finally solve the problem, and they get back together at the end. And that mentality really does affect a lot of Christians. This idea that there's a right thing that I can do, and if I can just do the right thing, everything will be fixed. It affects Christians who are trying to minister to other Christians, and they think, if I could just say the right thing, I can make this person better. And what I need for you to understand, what the Bible teaches you, is that this world is so broken that oftentimes there's not a right thing. Oftentimes there's just not a right thing. When God told Abraham to send his son Ishmael into the wilderness, he protested. He said, I can't do that. How can I do it? It's the wrong thing. And God answered basically saying, there's no right thing. Isaac can't grow up with Ishmael bullying him and standing over him. You're going to have to get rid of him. There's no right thing. Some of you are facing that day in and day out. If you have children and a job and a marriage, then you could have always worked more. You didn't work as hard as you could have. And you could have always been a better father. And you could have always been a better mother. And you could have always been a better spouse. And oftentimes you have to make decisions between the two or three different directions, things that you ought to do. And there's not a right thing. 4 years ago, yesterday, I was in Colorado on a once-in-a-lifetime vacation that I was not going to be able to recreate for my kids. And I was being a good father. And my sister was in the hospital in Tennessee. And I had to choose whether to be a good father or a good brother. And it was impossible to be both. And my sister died. And yes, that is my deathbed regret, that I didn't go get to be with her. But it's not a regret like I did the wrong thing. I made the right decision. It's just that there wasn't a right decision. That's what living in a world of death is like. That's what living in a world of death is like. Sometimes there's just not a right decision. You have to choose the best that you can. And you've got to trust Jesus with it. Sometimes both sides are wrong. Sometimes both sides are right. And you've got to choose. You've got to do your best to support both. And if you don't understand that, then what we end up doing is when we force these simple answers on people and they don't work, we end up vilifying the victim. If I've given you my short, easy, quick answer and you still struggle with depression, you still struggle with addiction, you still struggle with divorce, you still struggle with whatever it is, then it must be your fault. And I can't handle you not getting fixed by my pat answers, so I'm going to have to force you out. A failure to truly understand the devastating nature of living in a world that is under the power of death. So we don't want to live in that world, so we pretend that it's not that broken that badly or it's easy to fix. And the final way we get shipwrecked, if it's not through idealism, it's through cynicism. It's the belief that there's no hope. A cynic is simply an idealist who met reality. You thought it was all so simple, didn't you? And it wasn't. So now you don't want to try. And rather than trying, you want to just sit on the sidelines and criticize everything. The thing I hate about cynics is it's so easy. Yeah, you're always going to be right. You can sit on the sideline and no matter who's in charge, you can give reasons why they're going to fail. And they will fail because they live in a fallen world. And you're always going to be right, but you're never going to be part of the solution. A lot of reformed, if you don't know the lingo, that's kind of our camp, Presbyterian camp. A lot of us fall into this way. We pervert the belief in the fallenness of the world to a hopeless mentality that just believes that nothing's ever going to change. And the problem of that view is that it is a complete denunciation of the gospel. You see, Habakkuk and Jeremiah don't simply sit in their misery. They sit in the brokenness of the world. They sit in their sorrow, but they maintain their faith and their hope there. How do they do that? Well, I can tell you how we can do that. We do that by remembering that God has chosen to redeem this world rather than to judge it. We focus our hearts on the personality of God, on the character of God, and we see that He has chosen to redeem this world rather than to judge it. First of all, He has demonstrated a supernatural patience. When the bad news of the world is coming in too fast, what do? Turn it off. God never turns it off. He's always there. When the bad news of the world, when the pain of the world is coming in, one of the ways we insulate ourselves is by saying, well, at least I don't know them. I confess to you, I do this every day. I do this every single day. I read the headlines. Something terrible has happened in Tulsa last night, every night. But I quickly say, oh, well, that's not my part of town. I didn't know them. And I shut it off. God doesn't have that coping mechanism. He always knows them. Every little girl who gets hurt or molested or abused is His daughter, and He knows her dearly. And it's happening right in His face. And He's being patient, incredibly, supernaturally patient. And that patience causes us to tremble, and it causes us to have problems. We don't understand why. And we get angry with Him. And when we get angry, we have to remember that He's not only being patient, but He has already suffered for this world. He has already accepted the... I want you to hear how I say this very carefully. He has not admitted that it's His fault. He's not saying the brokenness of the world is His fault, because it's not. But He has taken the blame for it. He's taken the blame. When you see the Olympics this week, about 100 times this week, you're going to see the statue, Christ the Redeemer, towering over Rio. 98 feet white statue of supposedly of Christ, extending His hands and blessing the city. And every time you see it, I want you to remember that is wrong. The glory of Christ is that He did not stay on the mountain. Because you see, at the bottom of that mountain is one of the most violent, one of the most polluted slums in the world. And He didn't stay on the mountain. He went down into the slums. And He died in those slums. He died for the wretched and the poor. He died to turn this world and to change them and to give them a hope. And when you see Christ on the cross, you have to remember, if you're going to maintain your faith, you have got to remember that is God Himself suffering there. He suffered all the pain and misery of this world of death. He is not absent. He is not uncaring. He has taken the blame. He has borne our griefs. He has borne our sorrows. The chastisement of our peace was upon Him. And you have to sit in the crucifixion, and you have to apply the crucifixion to the brokenness of your own heart. So we're going to go through all these painful, these miserable questions that are more honest than we want to be. And we're going to say, God, You saw every wrong thing that happened. He's going to say, yes. And we're going to say, You could have stopped it, and You didn't. And He's going to say, yes. And we're going to cry, and we're going to say, we don't understand why. And He's going to say, tell me more. And we're going to say, that makes me angry. And He says, I understand. Tell me, what do you want to do? I want to yell at you. I want to spit on you. Do you want to hit me? I want to hit you. Do you want to beat me? I want to beat you. Do you want to beat me with whips? No. Do you want to nail me to a cross? I've done it. I have suffered for the pain and misery of this world. And I know you don't get it now, but you can trust me. You can trust me. I suffered for it voluntarily. I've hurt for it. And not only that, but we remember that by the resurrection, He's broken the power of death. He's not eradicated death yet, but resurrection is a sure sign that He will eradicate it. Paul says, for as by a man came death, by a man has also come the resurrection of the dead. For as in Adam all die, so also in Christ all shall be made alive. But each one in his own order. Christ the first fruits, then at His coming those who belong to Christ. Then comes the end, when He delivers the kingdom to the Father after destroying every rule and every authority and every power. He must reign until He's put all His enemies under His feet, and the last one to be destroyed is death. He will destroy death. Revelation says He will throw it into the lake of fire. He will throw death itself into the lake of fire, and there will be no more death and no more tears. And until that time, by the power of His Holy Spirit, He is redeeming His children. He is now at work, silently, frustratingly slow, but unstoppably, claiming His children one by one. We're told that in the book of Revelation, when the fifth seal is opened, you see underneath the altar, and underneath the altar are the souls of all those who have gone before. And you know what they're saying? How long? What are you waiting on? Fix it. And he says, a little while longer. If I come too soon, I'm not going to get all my children. And I'm going to wait until every one of them come home. He said, just a little while longer until the number is complete. It's frustrating, isn't it? It's frustrating. I don't know how to tell this story other than without sounding like Paul Harvey telling the rest of the story. And I don't want to sound like Paul Harvey. So I'm going to tell you how it ends first. Okay, Tim Keller describes his genealogy like this. He says his great-great-great-grandfather had four wives. The first three died in childbirth. Over the course of his life, he had 17 children, most of whom died in childbirth or died while they were children. Now, there tends to be this kind of chronological, insulation we put around ourselves, and we think, oh, that was easier back then. It wasn't. He went through a life-crushing event three times and saw children, child after child, die. His heart was crushed to the point of powder. Can you imagine how he cried out, Lord, how long? When are you going to fix this? His 17th child was the great-great-grandfather of Tim Keller. Isn't that interesting? Who's been the spiritual father of us all. If you've heard my preaching, then you've heard his. Isn't that interesting? Can you imagine that conversation? How long? And Jesus saying, I know. If I could show you now what I'm going to do with the descendant of your 17th child, maybe it would make it up for you. Maybe not, but when I show you glory, it will definitely make it up. Trust me. Trust me. And until then, we live a life doing four things. We live a life of hope, of believing that God is going to be at work and a better day is coming. We live a life of empathy. I beg you to live a life of empathy. Just stop being tribal. Stop turning your heart off when you hear bad news and thinking, well, they probably deserved it. When you see someone who's poor, stop thinking, oh, the only reason they're poor is they refuse to work. I have no time for that one. I always thought, well, I wonder how my mom would have taken that piece of information if I told her that everybody around me today tells me that if you work, you're not going to be poor. And she only worked three jobs. That's all. That's all. She just was lazy. That's it. Have empathy. Put yourself in their position. Have compassion. Believe in something better for them. And ultimately have action. Do what you do. If you're a crier, cry. If you're a prayer, pray. If you're a giver, give. If you're a doer, do. But let's work together. God is at work redeeming this world. Let's be part of the solution. Please pray with me.